All right, well, I guess I'm supposed to be the moderator for this call. And I wanted to say thank you to Tara and Jackie for posting your notes and your synopsis from the last meeting. I personally thought those were really useful to go back and kind of look at and remember, so thanks, guys. And I guess, does anybody have any questions kind of lingering from last time before we jump into new material?
I didn't.
Okay. I'll take that as a no. I'm trying to be the good instructor and wait a few minutes for people to formulate questions if they have them before moving on. All right, so then why don't we pick an article like we did last time? We'll pick an article and start there. So do we have votes for whether we do the Castro Soto's article or the, I know I'm going to say this last name wrong, but I'm just going to say the Thompson article. I'm afraid I'll butcher the other last name.
Yeah.
So I'd like to suggest that you start with the Lit Review one.
Okay.
Because I think it starts broad, and then I think the Thompson is a much more very, very focused, specific study.
Right. I think that sounds great. So then we'll start with the Castro Soto Lit Review. All right. What were some things that jumped out at people from this article?
I noticed more. I just kind of like highlighted a couple studies where I was like, I might be interested in reading, because they, you know, I mean, they kind of highlighted a bunch of different things, but I was kind of like, oh, well, that, like the whole thing. Let's see, 3.2.2. You know, we had talked about the null hypothesis versus the alternative hypothesis.
Right.
Sort of students' misconceptions with that. We did talk about that, right? I'm not mentioning that. Okay.
Yeah, I remember that too.
And, you know, I mean, they didn't really go into it, you know, in a whole lot of depth, but I liked that, you know, I didn't know that these, because I had done a lot of stuff looking at sampling distributions and stuff when I was doing my dissertation, and I didn't know these studies were out there. The article. So the Silos. Like, they've got a whole series of articles kind of related to, you know, believing that the null hypothesis and the acceptance regions are the same thing, believing that a hypothesis can refer to both a population and a sample. I guess maybe just, like, kind of that whole section, there was a lot of stuff from the Silos. And so,
And if you go back and look, I believe that one of those articles, and so it's not surprising that you didn't find those, but I think one is that person's dissertation.
Yeah, I noticed one of them was a proceedings. One of them is a
dissertation, and I've never heard of.
Well, one of them was in Spanish, but that didn't help anything.
But I think it's all stemming from that person's dissertation work.
Okay.
Journals that, at least, I mean, Randy, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they're journals that I don't frequent a lot, so I'm not sure how mainstream they are, how well they show up in certain searches.
Right, depending upon the database that you're using.
Right.
Yeah. But it seemed like, you know, these two people, but Ventanero, I thought I'd heard that name before somewhere along the way. Was something that I did. But that seemed to be like kind of the two names that, in this particular section where they were talking about what was sort of the headline of the section. I guess just hypothesis test. I mean, there were several other names in here, but...
Carmen Batanero is a faculty member over in Spain, and she's been involved in stats education stuff for a long, long time. So as we get further into things, she will be a name that pops up a lot.
Okay.
And she'll be associated a lot with a lot of her students that came through.
And, I mean, just kind of on the theory side of it, I just was interested to see sort of the I don't know, I don't know why I hadn't really sort of put the whole idea of the conditional statements. And I just never really thought about it the way that they phrased it in here.
Yeah,
talking about... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you mean the significance level?
Yeah, when they were talking
about...
Yeah, I don't know why I had never really put the two of those things together as part of the reason of you know, students' misconceptions that, you know, the whole idea of conditional probabilities early on and then, you know, the fact that they don't see that when we talk about alphas and p-values and the interpretations of p-values and that sort of thing. So I don't know, I just thought that was really interesting and something that just jumped out for me personally. So I don't mean to go on and on, but there you go.
No, those were all things that I had highlighted too. One of the other things that I was thinking about that I actually thought was kind of funny was what they coined as belief in the law of small numbers. That people just assume no matter what a sample size is, it will be representative of the population, and the problems that can lead to. And I thought that one was kind of interesting because that to me almost seemed like putting too much faith in a sample, especially a small sample, and too much faith in just kind of a sample procedure, whereas some of the other things we had talked about last time sort of implied that students may have a hard time putting any faith in sampling. You know, we talked about how it came up about how, you know, especially when students were dealing with people, they felt like taking a sample was just inherently unfair, and that you wouldn't get a good representation of the population. So I thought that that was kind of interesting that there were almost, it seemed like, two competing perspectives going on there.
Interesting.
Tara and Jackie, what did you guys think about this article?
Hold on, I'm writing.
Go ahead, Tara.
Oh. Sorry.
Go ahead, Jackie, sorry.
The only kind of thing I probably would add is just at the very, very beginning of that section, 3.2, I just think there was like a big point where it said that they also believe that there's a large number of instructors that share the same misconceptions with their students in the first place. And, I mean, just when I've been reading, you know, a few of these articles, there's a lot of times that I'm thinking, you know, I didn't realize that was a problem and that I've never actually thought of that being a problem. And so I might not even be addressing some of these things that maybe I am putting misconceptions in my students about because I'm not addressing them in the first place. So like in the second article, you know, they talk about, I've never thought about confusing the population distribution with the sampling distribution. I've never known that's a problem until I read that article.
Uh-huh. Which I think is a slightly related but different point. This is Holly Lynn. To what I think some of the things that they were saying in 3.2, I think there's a difference in an instructor having a misconception or in an instructor not being aware that such a misconception may exist but not necessarily having that misconception themselves.
No, I was going to say, I did see a little bit of that when I was looking, when in my own dissertation work, when I was looking at sampling distributions. There's definitely, I saw that in some of my student responses, that there was definitely confusion between probability distributions and sampling distributions, and whether it's an issue of terminology or just not knowing there is a difference, you know, it was hard to really piece out exactly what it was that they weren't, because, you know, my responses were fairly short, so it was hard to figure out what part of it they weren't getting, but they were using probability distribution for kind of everything. So, anyway, sorry, just thought I'd throw that in there.
I think there's one of the points that I hear you making is just about the kinds of... you know, the kinds of questions you were asking in your dissertation, you know, you were trying to get out their thinking. And one of the things that I noticed in, you know, the few, I mean, so there's a lot of references that they have in this article, but they explicitly say that there were very few that fulfilled their criteria for being an empirical study you know, with the population of interest that they were looking at being university students, and that a lot of those studies were, it appeared based on the way that they were describing these, that they were kind of survey multiple choice types of questions that they were choosing, you know, responses to. And I think sometimes it's, and they even say in here, it's very hard to kind of tease out, well, what are they reasoning? Go ahead. Just, I mean, how students interpret certain responses on a survey and, you know, in selecting it, they, you know, if they really understood what that choice was about, they may not have selected it.
Yeah, no, I know personally I found when I was doing, because I did something with the chaos test, which, of course, is multiple choice. But then I also did some labs that had some assessment questions, and then I had some interview questions. And really, the meat of what I wrote up in my results really came from the interview results and looking at, you know, them trying to explain their thinking and trying to figure out why it is they answered what they did, because most of the responses were wrong. And so then trying to figure out, or wrong in some shape or fashion, what the reasoning was that they were using. And I know, you know, in statistics education studies, you know, it's statistics, so a lot of times there's a little bit of a push for some more quantitative type of results, but it really was the qualitative responses that, for this type of analysis, that, you know, trying to figure out what their reasoning is and what it is, their logic process, that the interview responses were really, that was where I got like the meat of my results and the most interesting stuff and the most alarming stuff, honestly. So just to kind of follow up, that was Holly Lynn, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Oh, and this is Jackie. I'm just one other thing about the conditional probability that you all were talking about. I know last time we were talking about, you know, at what point and how much probability do students really need to understand.
Uh-huh.
And so this article really kind of makes you feel like, you know, at some point maybe we at least have to address the conditional probability. We might not need to, you know, maybe go through all the formal probability steps, but at some point it seems like they really need to understand a conditional, and do they ever?
I think that's a good point.
I agree. And is it this, the problem with confusing like A given B with B given A, that has a name. Is it the conjunction fallacy or something like that?
I think
you're right.
Using the inverse or something like that is what I've heard of it. But
yeah, I think that one is the Falk phenomenon.
Okay.
Pretty sure. Yeah.
I've heard it called the Falk, and I think I've heard it called the conjunction as well.
I'd have to look it up again.
Yeah, it's something that I know has been pretty well documented in probability, you know, in probabilistic reasoning. Going back, I know one of the articles that I'm thinking of, which of course I can't remember the citation off the top of my head, but I know at least one of the articles was at this point several decades old, so it's well documented and it's apparently still a persistent problem. And it was, I think what was interesting to me is I had never thought about, I knew they always had problems understanding what the p-value is telling you, what alpha was telling you, and I had never thought about it before in light of, you know, it was this particular fallacy where they were confusing the conditional. They were confusing what was going on. So I thought that was interesting to me, and I completely agree with what I think Jackie just said about how that's something, or was that Tara? I'm sorry.
No, Jackie.
With what she just said about how that's something we really, I guess, are going to have to address with students. And how, you know, just like we were in a course where we taught, or the course I was at Michigan, you know, we taught conditional probability, but that just teaching them conditional probability, they still had problems with these similar types of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was interesting how this article talked about there was a set of authors that was saying that our language just may be confusing students. Instead of saying A given B, maybe say A within B or A in B, about how we're not only going to have to make sure that we're teaching at least that much of probability, but we really need to look at a new way to teach that area of probability. Since that particular, since conditional probabilities are something that students have really struggled with for a long time now.
Yeah, didn't they also say something about dropping significant somewhere?
Yeah, that was in their discussion of practical importance versus statistical significance.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I don't know if anybody else, you know, highlighted that.
Yeah, and that I've even tried to actually teach with a few of my students, you know, is just because something's statistically significant doesn't mean it actually has practical significance. I think that's hard for them.
Yeah, I agree. That's something I've taught, tried to teach as well. And I think, you know, it's difficult, and it's especially difficult to then see the other side of that coin about even if something's not statistically significant, it doesn't mean it's completely unimportant. Or that there's no actual effect going on. So, yeah, that's something that I know students kind of struggle with.
I was just curious, because I didn't read the study, obviously, but their solution was to literally drop the word significant from data analysis vocabulary and use it only in the everyday sense to describe something actually noteworthy. So I was just wondering how they would have been, what language they would use. Yeah, you know, like, I don't know.
That's a really good question.
Yeah, like what their
alternative was.
Yeah, what their alternative was. So
that's a really good question.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, I don't know, I can't think of a single word, but the idea of just unlikely to occur by chance or. But yeah, I think it. Yeah, I mean, it's a good example of one of those things that really is. I mean, it's out there now, and it's pretty much embedded in the discipline. But it's really an unfortunate choice of language when it was first formulated, teaching-wise, anyway.
Yeah, because I know, you know, my own writing. There are times when I want to use the word significant in an everyday sense as important. And I have, you know, and I stop myself and try to choose a different word because I don't want to imply that there was some test that, you know, that was done that gave me a significant, statistically significant result.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, the other thing that caught my eye is just, it was in the confidence interval section. I don't know if anybody else noticed this. I was kind of curious. The Fiddler 2006 suggests that confidence intervals help decrease the misconception that a statistically not significant result is equivalent to a not practically significant. Like, I found that really interesting, and I was like, okay, so what exactly did Fiddler do? But they don't really, like, tell you much. Like, basically, confidence intervals help students making that distinction between, you know, statistical significance and practical significance. But actually using it in a confidence interval format was better than a hypothesis test format. But then they don't really explain what Fiddler did. So I'm like,
right. Okay.
So what did they do? So that was just one other thing I saw with the whole statistical significance. Anyway.
I mean, overall, kind of, I agree with you that there are some studies that they really gave sufficient detail on. That you really kind of understood what was happening, and others that were kind of flopped over that you were kind of left wondering, all right, I'm not really sure what to make of this.
Yeah.
That, and I agree with you. That's one place where I felt that as well.
Hmm.
Yeah, I just thought that was a really interesting result, and I would have liked to have known more information, so I guess I'll have to find Fiddler 2006.
Yeah.
But I think that's also related to writing lit reviews. And, you know, you don't want a lit review to be a just synopsis after synopsis of every study. You do want there to be, real true synthesis happening across studies. But at the same time, there have to make choices about when should I give enough information to contextualize what I'm saying here into to at least give enough information for someone to take away and interpret, you know, interpret what I'm saying in an informed way.
Yeah. And I did really like the chart on page 108. That actually was very nice. Kind of.
Is that the one that outlines all the misconceptions?
Yeah. I mean, that did kind of.
Yeah.
Because I have to admit, you know, I just last quarter, winter quarter, I gave some students some problems out of the DeVoe book, which is really good about highlighting some of the misinterpretations of confidence intervals and, like, making statements and, you know, incorrect conclusions from confidence intervals and having students say, okay, what is wrong with this, you know, conclusion or this interpretation of a confidence interval? And even for me, some of them, it took me a minute to figure out, you know, oh, what is wrong with this, you know, conclusion from a confidence interval? And so, you know, and I just, as I was reading some of these, it reminded me of, you know, some of these misconceptions, they are really tricky and they are really,
Well, they're really kind of subtle, I think.
Yeah, subtle is a good word.
Why, I've done that too, and I always feel like such an idiot going, shoot, I should know this. But it can be hard because some of them, it could be an issue with the language where you're not really reading the language carefully enough to pick up on what the difference is, or you're not thinking about the mathematics carefully enough to recognize what the difference is. So I agree. Some of these can be really difficult. You know,
yeah.
Even for people that have studied this for a while, so how much more must it be for people that are learning this for the first time?
Well, no, there was at least one of them. I was standing in front of my class, and, you know, they're asking me about it, and I'm like, all right, wait a minute. I know this is not right, but why is this not right? I'm feeling like an idiot. So that's always a good feeling.
Yeah. That's when your response is, well, why do you think it's not correct?
And I think that is pretty much what I did. I was like, you know, so what do you guys think, you know?
Right.
Gives me time to... Anyway.
So does anyone have any other comments on this article? Or should we move to the next one?
I had a couple things.
All right.
That we didn't talk about yet. I thought it was interesting on page 106, they talked about the belief in the mathematical proof. When you're doing hypothesis testing, my students get that wrong all the time. When they consider the hypothesis test as a mathematical proof. So you're proving it to be true or false.
Yeah.
They also talked about a probabilistic proof by contradiction. I don't see that one very much with my student population, but that they consider the test a mathematical proof, I see all the time.
So
yeah.
I'd like to raise a question. To hear, because I was, I found the way that they described what they were calling the probabilistic proof by contradiction to be a little confusing. What were you all's take on exactly what that meant? What would a student be doing if they were taking that approach? Was this Sarah who was just talking?
Yes.
I thought that section was really interesting, too, because I think it also kind of may be related to a lot of the things that have been written recently about the difference between kind of pure mathematical thinking and statistical thinking.
I guess what I took away from their allusion was the idea, again, that the p-value is kind of the that the p-value relates more or less to the probability that the null is true or the null is false. That was kind of how I was thinking of it, because that again, I do see a lot with students, so that they would, I don't know if that's quite crossing the line to saying that it's absolutely proven true or absolutely proven false, and if there's really a point in drawing that line between whether it's absolutely proven true or whether we just or whether it's absolutely proven false, or whether we just think there's a low probability it's false. I don't know. Or a high probability it's false. But that was kind of how I was thinking of it, was if HO is improbable, then, which was their conclusion of the illusion, which I think is where they're saying the problem takes place, is going from kind of the second premise to the conclusion. if HO is improbable, that means it's false.
Okay.
I'm going to be honest. I had no idea. I'm still reading it. It's still, I'm not.
I'm not really clear on what they mean. I do think that, was that Horla who just gave an interpretation?
Yeah.
That may be one way of interpreting what they said, but I'm not sure if that's the way that they were trying to describe this. I still am kind of confused on what they mean by the probabilistic proof.
But obviously, it has something to do with the little table at the top. If there's
confused when they talk about basically the probability of a p-value, because then you're talking about the probability of a probability. So I mean, that confuses me from the very beginning.
Yeah. Okay.
Randy, do you have a take on that?
No, I really don't have anything. I'm not sure either.
They were really trying, and based on the way that they're talking about it, it sounds like these are two categorizations that they came up with. Well, no, I guess it's coming from Falk, that they're saying the probabilistic proof is from Falk and Greenbaum, and the mathematical proof is from the Valisio. I guess that's the first place they bring it up. But then
Does anybody know it?
I have to go back and read those two articles.
Yeah. Does anybody know what modus tollens method is?
I think it's one of the rules of logic that if P implies Q, then the complement of Q implies the complement of P. That's kind of what I remember from like high school logic.
Sense with the table.
It got it up in the table.
Yeah, that would make sense with the table.
Yeah. I guess the thing that I thought was actually kind of interesting about this example is that they were trying to take, like, I remember having to do logical proofs about how you got from point A to point B, and you had to write down all these little rules you learned. So that's where I recognized the modus tollens. So I thought it was interesting that they tried to actually apply it back to a formal way of thinking about logic. Whether or not we kind of understand their application, I thought that was an interesting attempt.
Right.
It's a novel idea. But. All right, does anybody have any other questions or ideas about comments about this article?
This is Tara again. The only other comment that I had was I thought it was interesting that all of their studies, most of the studies, they said were post-test only. So if we're only looking at the post-test, we're not taking into consideration any prior knowledge, and we're not looking at how they're developing their ideas. I thought that was an interesting point.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree. And then wasn't one of their final conclusions was that someone needs to kind of look at the methodology for doing studies like this? But what does that say, that we're still seeing all these misconceptions when they're walking out of a class?
Well, if they're not making any concerted efforts to, I mean, so it also doesn't describe necessarily what they were trying to do through their instruction.
Right.
Without knowing what they were trying to accomplish through their instruction, it's hard to interpret whether their results are good or bad.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've ever seen this journal, Educational Research Review. It's obviously only been around since 06. But it's one of the few journals that I know of that really, really focuses on lit reviews. I mean, so I actually went to the journal's homepage and started looking through other articles and the kinds of other articles that are written, and it really seems like a really nice outlet for papers that are really trying to be, you know, lit review. And those are sometimes harder to get published in some of the other mainstream journals. What's unfortunate is that, for example, this particular article, if it wouldn't have been logged by CauseWeb, how many stats ed people would have ever found it?
I actually didn't find it on CauseWeb. I don't even know if it's there. I found it because I was doing a search in Eric for something else. I think it was Eric or JSTOR or something. I don't remember where. But I found it by accident. I don't know if it's on CauseWeb's site.
Literature Index. Sorry, just going to take a quick look.
We should certainly submit it there, especially since it's very focused on looking at studies with undergraduates. Which I understand why they made the choice they did to restrict their studies, but I think there are other studies looking at particularly AP stats students, high school, junior senior level stats classes, that the difference between an undergraduate in statistics and a junior or senior in statistics are very minimal. And I think that they would have found a lot more studies if they would have expanded it.
Right.
Yeah, it's not actually on CauseWeb at the moment. But so, yeah, I wonder if they know about this particular journal. Anyway.
Well, should we turn our attention to the other article for a little while?
Can I make one last comment?
Yeah.
And this just might be something general just about probability, and I'm sure most of you have seen this too, but I think one of the hardest things when it comes to a lot of things that we're doing, like, you know, with alpha and all these other things that we're learning and teaching our students and even confidence intervals, is that most of these probabilities that we're talking about is before we actually ever have data. And they don't understand that, you know, once you actually already have an actual problem that you're working with, once you have data, a lot of your probabilities are now zero or one.
Yeah.
And like, there's a big difference to, you know, before I have data, there's a 95% chance I'll capture the mean. Once I have data, I either have or have not. And I think that's a really hard leap for students to understand that there's a probability before you have data and there's a certainty or uncertainty once you're done. And I don't know. Just a weird little random thought of my day.
But I don't think I think it's also related to, and I can't remember, I think, I don't know if it was, I'm pretty sure it wasn't talked about in this one, but in the Saladna, and I don't know how to say his name either, Lewis, I hope it's Lewis. In Lewis's and Pat's article, they talk about Knold's study where he talks about the outcome approach, where people will perceive a probability question as being, trying to say whether something is going to happen for this particular trial, whether it is or is not. And but yet, you know, Jackie that had said this, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I hear you saying is that in certain situations, we want them to be able to think, well, yes, now that you've got the data, it's either in there or it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this a priori, you know, use of usefulness of probability, and then, you know, once the event has happened, and once a coin has already flipped, you know, whether it's a head or a tail, is either a zero or a one. But before I flip it, and so like saying, you know, whether or not it's a head, I should say, and whether or not it's a head, it's either yes or no, it's a zero or a one. But with before I flipped it, I could think about it being 50%.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes alpha so hard for students because, you know, you say it's probably the type 1 error. But, you know, once you failed to reject the null hypothesis, what's the chance you made a type 1 error? Zero. I didn't reject the null. I think that's hard.
Yeah. I don't think your observation is trivial at all. I think it really speaks to kind of one of the heart of the difficulties of probabilistic reasoning and integrating it with something that's useful for statistics.
Yeah, and I think that's the type of thing where even when you try to explain to them the difference, they're still not taking that explanation to heart. Like, it's not actually affecting the way they think. Because I've done something similar in class where the first time I introduce alpha, beta, all of those, and then I talk about, well, okay, this probability, the difference before the test and after, the example you were just giving, I can ask them a question 2 minutes later about what's the probability now that we have our decision, what's the probability that we made a type 1 error? And they still say 5%. You know, they, even immediately, like, after you discuss it in class, it's not, it's still not sinking in, it's still not resonating with them. So I think that's something they really, really struggle with.
And that actually almost seems to come back down to our conditional probability issue.
Yeah. So those are the two things in answer to, or in partial answer to one of our questions from last time, what probability do they need to know? They need to know conditional probabilities, and they need to understand the distinction between a theoretical probability before actually having data, and then the change that occurs once you have the data.
Well, it seems so obvious, I think, to me, because when I've tried to teach things, you know, you're like, I'll do something obvious, like, ooh, these two teams are playing football on Sunday. There's a chance that one of them win is 60%, but once the game's over,
right?
we know what happened. Right. So, and I still don't think they get it, but.
Related to the idea of, kind of information-based probability, that the probabilities need to be based on the information that you have. Before data, you don't have that much information. After data, you have more information, so your probability should change.
That's a good point. I don't think I've ever really, like, that's, I think, kind of how I've been trying to explain it, but I don't think I've ever put it in those words, and I like that.
Doesn't that depend on what approach you take, though? Because that's more of a Bayesian approach as opposed to a frequentist approach. The Bayesian approach is, once I have the data, it will influence. I mean, just theoretically thinking about it, isn't that a difference?
That's a good question. I wasn't thinking about it that deeply. I was taking information in kind of the colloquial sense as opposed to thinking statistically. Just, you know, I don't know. I guess I wasn't thinking that deeply about it.
Well, but I think it may speak to that, that perhaps we need to be able to know that. So I think a lot of probability instruction is very much from a theoretical perspective, from a very kind of classical, let's just compute the hell out of everything. And it doesn't necessarily take in, it's not always taught from a frequentist or more of a kind of a Bayesian or subjectivist type of approach. And I guess the kind of things that this is all these conversations are making me think more deeply about is, you know, teaching probability from more of a, you know, from a frequentist or a Bayesian or subjective kind of approach, or trying to do, you know, expose students to thinking that, you know, being able to approach it in multiple ways, perhaps a hypothesis is that it may be more fruitful in supporting statistical reasoning.
Mm.
I don't know.
Well, I think, isn't that, I mean, the second article, when they were mm-hmm. describing, I mean, that kind of gets at a little bit, when they were talking about building the samples and the more whites with the reds, and, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that kind of gets at that a little bit, you know, because, I mean, basically, she just kind of starts talking about, you know, probabilities, and they're drawn samples, and then, you know, sort of building that up to the get at the concept of the sampling distribution and what's likely and what's unusual. So I think, yeah, I think you've got a really good point there that, you know, this conversation back and forth about whether probability
is necessary or not necessary for understanding these later concepts. I don't know. There is a really strong argument for needing, you know, that those ideas are really intertwined.
Right, and it may just be that the oftentimes when we of you know probability instruction, what comes to mind is the way that it's often taught, very theoretically, very computational based,
yeah.
Formula driven. Well, that may be necessary, but that may not be the most supportive for building the foundation for other ideas.
Well, yeah, because what they did in this article is they just, you know, they took samples and just kind of dealt with what they got, these little, you know, trying to predict what was in the bag of marbles or whatever, or the bag of candies or jelly beans or whatever it was. I don't remember.
I think it was jelly beans.
Yeah. But I did, I mean, you know, I guess to kind of segue to the second article. I just, for me, like, reading the second article, I just remember thinking as I was reading what they actually did, I was like, wow, this is a great way to introduce this. If I had time to do this, like, I just really like this.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a teaching tool, maybe, you know. I was like, I might do something like this if I had time. So,
yeah, I often find when I'm reading these type of research articles that I'm distracted by thinking about how I could use this information in my classroom.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was a cool way to approach this activity. I thought one of the things that was interesting that they saw out of this was the one girl was, I think her name might have been Leslie. How they kind of picked up from her reasoning that she was, instead of thinking about how the individual samples work together to inform the population parameter, just taking the individual samples and then lumping them into one giant sample. I thought that was interesting because in my mind, in some ways, that kind of connected back to a little bit of what they saw about what students thinking that any sample will do a good job of representing the population, I made notes about this. I have to make sense of my notes now. Or I think what they were saying, not necessarily about an individual sample representing the population, but that the sampling distribution for any large samples would look like a population, would look like the population, as opposed to looking normal or something like that in the case of the mean. And part of my thinking was, well, if they're imagining this being a larger sample size and we tell them that larger sample sizes do a better job of representing the population, then that may be why they expect the sampling distribution to look like the population as opposed to having its own, you know, predictable shape in many cases. So I thought that was kind of an interesting point. I'm curious, you know, how many students kind of follow, you know, is that a common line of reasoning among students, that they just kind of think of these repeated samples but then treat them as if they were one large sample?
Mm. Interesting.
What were some other things people noticed out of this article?
Jackie, so I'll chime in with my couple of random thoughts. I guess my first one is probably very similar to what you were just talking about, Herla, about the idea of the population distribution, how they think the sampling distribution should look very, very similar to it as the sample size gets bigger. And, I mean, I guess I even find this when I try to introduce sampling distributions. You know, a lot of us look at graphs and try to show them what happens. And one of the biggest confusing things I have is I actually start, you know, with the actual sample, okay, and N60. And when we're looking at, you know, 20 samples of size 3, and then you see this N gets spit out as 20, but that's, I have 20 samples of N equals 3, and that's, I think, the two levels of N that we're working with can actually confuse them, especially when you're trying to use just, like, simulation examples or just graphical examples and not hands-on ones, that it's hard to understand that you have, like, in a sense, two levels of sample when you're looking at a sampling distribution. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I made a note about that, too, that I had experienced the same thing in my classroom, that there's always a confusion between the N in terms of the number of samples I'm taking, but also the N in terms of how many things I'm drawing for each sample, and that, you know, that is always a huge issue. So, yeah, I made little notes about that as well. Sorry, go ahead, Jackie.
And the only other thing that I really thought was really strange was on page 271, and this is just because my department's been talking a lot about writing well-written objectives. And if I even saw that the NCTM said that they want to understand how sample statistics reflect the values, and we don't really know what understand means. And
right.
It seems like with a lot of these objectives that we might be writing, it's sort of like how do you assess whether or not that's happening or not. And if we're starting with not knowing what we're wanting them to do, it's kind of hard to do it. So.
I noted that too, Jackie. This is Tara. We just went through and we had to rewrite every single student learning outcome for every one of our classes campus-wide. And they gave us a list of verbs that we were allowed to use. They all came directly from Bloom's taxonomy. And they were all reviewed to verify that they were measurable and everything. So I also wrote that down because we just went through a huge process about that last year.
Well, and I think that there's also a difference between a goal and an objective. And so I guess I've always interpreted NCTM statements like that to be goals. So we have a goal of helping students understand how sample statistics reflect the values, blah, 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 blah. But then in order to make it something much more tangible and accessible, you have to break that down into objectives. So that's where you have to dive in and say, okay, well, what does it really mean to understand things?
One of the other things that I highlighted in this article and their discussion on the role of variability is how really understanding kind of inference involves bringing two seemingly contrasting ideas together. So this is where they talk about, on page 274, sampling representativeness. The expectation that a sample taken from the population will be similar to that population or have characteristics similar to that population, and then also sampling variability, the expectation that different samples selected will differ from each other and from the common population, and how it's really hard for students to reconcile those two things in their mind, and that they can kind of deal with one at a time, and they're thinking can kind of shift back and forth between the two depending on what they're being asked to do, but they can't marry them. They can't reconcile them together, which looking at them, I was reading them going, yeah, that kind of is odd that we're telling our students, well, yeah, one sample is going to represent the population, so then another sample will represent the population, but then those two won't look like each other even though they both represent the same thing. And that, I think, can be a little weird for students. So I thought that was interesting is, you know, I've either never thought deeply enough about those two things or I've kind of reached a point where I can kind of work with them together. And so it was something that I hadn't thought about how unusual that must be to a novice that we're trying to convince them that these two things actually work together to help us do inference.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I really hadn't thought, about how those really do seem on the surface to sort of contradict each other. And yeah, we do kind of sound like we're saying two different things. We're trying to, you know.
Think we're crazy.
Yeah, you know, and so.
I think that was probably one of the bigger kind of wow factors for me out of the article, you know, that and the idea of aggregating the samples into one, which I talked about before.
That was in both articles, wasn't it?
It's possible. I highlighted it in the Thompson article.
Yeah, I think it was in both of them because I actually had written that down also as in kind of my overview for both articles I'd written it.
Yeah.
That struck me. And right above that also, when they talk about the importance of understanding variability, we talked about that a little bit last time.
Right. Anyone have anything else to say about this article?
I thought it was interesting that when you do high school research, they made sure that all their students had the same prior knowledge with respect to the courses they were coming from. But when you're in a college classroom, that's never going to be the case. Our students have such a diverse background of where they're coming from academically, at least for my student population. I assume it's the same everywhere. So does it make it harder because they don't all have that same starting point academically?
Yeah, even I think at small colleges, because like all our, for our class at Otterbein, I mean, everybody was supposed to take the same prerequisite course, but even at that, I mean, the people coming through that course, even though they took the same college algebra course, that doesn't mean that they necessarily had the same abilities or the same backgrounds or, I mean,
even
I
the same
have,
material.
Yeah, it was just wildly different levels of math, because I looked a lot at a lot of that when I was looking at my dissertation stuff, and, you know, even though they'd all taken Math 115, it, you know, different majors, different backgrounds, different, and it really made a huge difference in, you know, what I was looking at. So, you know, even if you're coming through with the same background, I think, you know, it's still, you're going to have wildly different, it's still going to be an issue, I guess, that's what I'm trying to say. You're still going to have students with wildly different backgrounds and ways of thinking about things. And,
yeah.
So, and, you know, algebra necessarily, I don't know if we've had huge arguments about this in our department, about whether, you know, college algebra is really necessary to understand the basic ideas of introductory statistics. And we've gotten round and round on that. So.
Yeah, we don't even have that as a requirement.
Yeah.
For our students. So, I mean, you know, we have students who have been out of school for 20 years coming into statistics, and somebody who just finished high school algebra coming in. So. The other things that I had written about that, I thought the teaching experiment methodology was interesting. I wrote a note to myself that was something I wanted to learn more about. And I thought that the fact that they had 17 sessions devoted to what they were working on and that their activities and lessons were revised daily based on the outcomes, it just seemed like it would be very, very time-consuming. And I couldn't imagine having 17 sessions to spend just on sampling distributions. There was no way you'd get through anything. That kind of struck me.
Yeah,
that's probably true.
A teaching experiment is and there are certainly differing opinions in the field about what qualifies as a teaching experiment. Some people use it very loosely, and then other people, like Pat Thompson, use it very specifically to mean a very specific thing. Where there's a constant interplay between your planning of the lessons and your ongoing analysis of what's happening in the classroom, and, you know, constant refinement of the trajectory, you know, that you're taking the students down, that you don't, you know, that he did not have those 17 days, you know, set in stone before he started, you know, that there was a plan and it evolved and changed every day after doing some analysis after each session. Where others tend to use teaching experiments where there is more of a kind of preset curriculum thing that you're going to try out, and that there's not much ongoing, there may be some ongoing analysis, but it doesn't necessarily affect the trajectory that you're taking your students on that drastically.
There was a nice kind of you know, not too complicated. I mean, there's the handbook that was released in 2000 has a couple of good articles on teaching experiments, but the NCTM 2006 yearbook has about oh, I don't know, it's probably like a 10-page article on teaching experiment methodology and statistics, and it has like, I think it's Donnie Benzvio is one of the authors, so he describes some of his teaching experiments in there, and there are one or two others, I think, that they summarize. So that's kind of a good, like, starting point if people are interested in learning more about teaching experiment methodology and, you know, like, especially applied to statistics. That might be kind of an interesting one to read at some point.
Yeah, and actually, I think that entire yearbook wouldn't be such a bad thing for you all to purchase. And I know that NCTM was... because that whole, so NCTM puts out a yearbook every year on different topics. And the 2006 topic was thinking and reasoning with data and chance. This summer they had a sale where I guess they were overstocked or whatever on this yearbook, that for dirt cheap they were selling copies of that yearbook.
Oh, yeah, I think I got it actually, now that I think about it. I saw that. This is Lee. Sorry. I was just thinking that, yeah, I bought the yearbook this year. Sorry, don't mind me.
It was the last chapter in there that Randy was referring to. It may be something that that Lee, if you do have that yearbook, that you could copy and give to everybody, because I think it would be nice to, for sure.
Yeah, Thinking and Reasoning with Data and Chance, 68th yearbook.
That's it.
Yeah, I could scan this and, which article was it? The one that we were talking about, Ben's V.
I think it's toward the end.
Learning from Teaching Experiments.
Learning from Teaching Experiments. Schaefer was
467.
Oh, yeah, very last one. Research in the Statistics Classroom, Learning from Teaching Experiments. Joan Garfield, Benzvi, Garfield, and Ziffler. So, yeah, I mean, if that's one that everybody thinks they might want to read, I can scan this and then put it in a PDF, and it's pretty short, actually.
Yeah,
that sounds good.
Scan it.
I think that's one of the things
that
start getting into this, that, you know, not only associated with learning more about the literature, but learning about research methodologies and thinking about getting familiar with those as far as planning any kind of research you guys are going to do.
I think that sounds like a good idea. And that could be a good segue then into what do we want to do for our next phone call, because we're up on an hour time, and I know everybody's busy. So I don't want to keep everyone too much longer, but what are kind of the lingering sentiments from this call? What are some questions people still have or still want to get answered? And then kind of how do we use that to decide where to go for next time?
I had a question actually that kind of went with this article. The article is focusing on sampling distributions for proportions. And I was wondering, is it easier for students to make a connection about sampling distributions for means than it is for them to make a connection for sampling distribution for proportions? Because I'm not sure how your classes go, but ours, we focus mostly on means all the way up to the end, and then all of a sudden I'm throwing proportions at them. At the same time, I'm throwing sampling distributions at them, getting it once. And I was wondering if it made it more difficult for them to understand the material and to be able to kind of grasp the idea of the sampling distribution.
That's an interesting question, because actually I've started to think, because the book I was using does mean first and then, you know, it does proportions second, and I've actually started to think, because there's some nice proportion like activities and things that you can do and kind of switching it up, and, you know, would that be better, you know, I kind of have the same question. I don't know if there's anybody who's done any work with that, you know, means versus proportions in terms of conceptual understanding. Is it easier with proportions and then means? Or I honestly don't know, but I've actually had the same question. So.
Yeah, I mean, I've done it both ways, and it didn't seem to make a huge difference, but I ended up shoving proportions at them in such a short period of time at the end that it wasn't really valid in my opinion. because I gave it to you real quick.
Yeah, I do seem to remember reading. I can't remember the article now, but I do remember reading an article where someone was arguing that proportions are actually a better starting point. It might have been in, I can't remember, I think it might have been in John Garfield and Bob Del Moss's stuff around 1999 or so on sampling distributions. And I think that a bunch of that was published in the Journal of Statistics Education. But that's another one I'd have to go back and look up again. But, yeah, I think that's an interesting question.
Pedagogically. I think it seems like it would make, you'd be able to make a tighter connection with probability, building from probabilistic ideas if you're using proportions.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What if you don't teach probability? What if you don't do a unit on probability?
Well, that's another interesting question, is that, you know.
And that goes back to the whole, how do you teach, you know, alpha as a conditional probability if you don't teach any probability? I mean, you know, you cover basic ideas, but you don't do anything in detail.
It'll be interesting how well your students understand the idea of a proportion. I mean, you know, proportions and percentages are, you know.
Not well understood sometimes, because we do in our developmental classes, we'll do a unit on percentages, and sometimes our students really struggle with them. It's not something they cover a lot in high school, and they do basic how to calculate a percentage, but they don't do a lot with it. It was just something that I had written down, kind of jumped out at me.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I was going to say, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I did kind of skim, you know, this other chapter that we had, and if we're still kind of interested in talking about samples and how they relate to how students sort of think about samples and how they relate to the population, I actually, from what I read when they started talking about what the kids actually did, I actually thought part of this chapter was really interesting. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't know how many people got a chance to look at it. I only really kind of skimmed it. But I might vote for, you know, looking at this chapter. If we're still sort of interested in looking at that, because I know that was a question we had at the first research call. We were kind of looking at, you know, how students understand the connection between a sample and a population. And it deals with fifth and sixth graders, but I remember thinking that, I don't know, I just, from what I looked at, it was actually, I thought it was really interesting.
It deals with fifth and sixth graders at the end, but it talks about studies that were done with adults and some other stuff at the beginning before it gets into the work that they actually did.
Oh, okay.
So I thought it was really interesting. I thought it was a fantastic, when they started going into their studies, it was a fantastic scaffolding.
Yeah, some of the descriptions of how they, like, describe the different sampling techniques that these kids came up with,
mm-hmm.
I was like, wow, that's actually really, like, they really kind of came up with great ways to describe the techniques that the kids came up with. That was the part that I was starting to really get into. So I would actually kind of put a vote in for the reading the chapter.
Yeah, I read most of it. I thought it was a very good chapter also.
I skimmed through it. I had read it previously before and skimmed through it again, and I'd like to hear some discussion on it.
All right, so then for next time, why don't we do that article, and then what about a methodological article, like this one on how to do teaching experiments? That sounded like
something
people were interested in, and it could give us some idea once we formulate our research question if that's a direction we want to go in. Does that sound good to people?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that works.
Really high and squeaky on that.
That's okay. So yeah, I'll because I got my scanner here at home. If everyone would like me to, I will scan this and send it out later today. If everybody has a copy of it.
I sent everybody two emails. One is a link to Pat Thompson's website that he actually started it when he was doing the teaching experiment and still has it up there. He has all of his lesson plans, his activities, the PowerPoints that he used. He really describes in detail what they did in that teaching experiment. So if you're interested in looking at some of his lessons and someone was saying that they were interested in trying out some of those ideas in their classroom, his materials are up there. The other email that I sent was a link to where you can buy that, the yearbook that we were just discussing, and it's, the current price is $15, and I definitely think it's well worth purchasing.
Yeah, it's a very nice book. I mean, I will put the vote in for it, too. I haven't had a chance to really read it, but it's just a very nice book. It looks very nice.
Right.
Quick question. The person that was the synthesizer last time.
That was me.
What exactly did you do?
I did the I did a summary, just a quick summary, major topics
okay.
that we talked about, and when the next call was and what we had to read for it, and then I sent it to Jackie. She sent me feedback, and then we posted it. So it's on the
okay.
group, the Google group thing. It's in there.
Okay. Yeah, sorry, I was very bad. I did not review everything that I should have before this, so thank you.
Yes, synthesizer this time. So are we all going to move down one job again?
Yeah.
Which I think based on, well, looking at, I think, Jackie's notes. So that would mean...
Nope, I did notes this time.
Oh, you did notes this
yeah.
time. You were the recorder, so then I think you would go to organizer
okay.
next time. Jackie, you become moderator. I become synthesizer, and Lee is the recorder.
Yeah.
So then we just need to set a time about
where
from now. So sometime in September.
All right. I would vote for a Tuesday or a Thursday. That's just because I have really heavy days on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, but I can do any day of the week. But I would vote
My
for a Tuesday or a Thursday.
Lighter as well.
My Tuesday and Thursday is lighter also.
Tuesday, Thursday works for me. As long as it's after, I have office hours until 11:30, so afternoon on either of those days would work for me.
I teach straight through until 2. I go 8 to 2 without any breaks on Tuesday and Thursday.
Oh,
so
oh,
I can't do it until the
like
afternoon.
2:05, right?
What?
I said we could just do a conference call at like 2:05 then, right?
Sure.
Are your Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays better?
No, I have 20 credits this semester, so Wednesday I go 8 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. with only like an hour or two break in between.
Oh, my goodness.
And Mondays I go 10 to 6:30 with only a half-hour break. So I have a really crappy semester.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Wow.
We couldn't find adjuncts, so I have a lot of classes and a lot of credits.
Is a Tuesday
okay.
afternoon looking good for a lot of people?
Is what?
Like a Tuesday or Thursday later afternoon, like 3-ish?
Yes, I
yeah,
can
that's
do 3.
Fine. Yeah, the only day I couldn't do, because I have to do the webinar on September 22nd at 2:30. So that's the only, like, Tuesday. I couldn't do that Tuesday. But everybody other date, I would be fine at 3, as far as I know.
What about Thursday the 17th?
Works for me.
That's good.
That's the week.
Yeah, I think that would be fine. So Thursday the 17th at 3 o'clock. Are there
yep.
any objections to that?
Mm-mm. Can't think of any.
All right.
All right.
So then we have Thursday, September 17th, making notes for myself because I will forget as soon as I hang up the phone. 3 p.m., and then we're definitely reading the book chapter that Randy sent last time, and then Lee will send the chapter about teaching experiments.
Yes.
All right. Sounds good.
All right.
All right. It was good to talk to everyone.
Yes. Have a great start to your semesters.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Good luck, everybody.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.